Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the one and only Gillian Anderson talks to me about playing a woman who becomes homeless and decides to walk the English coast in the new movie, The Salt Path. I also talk to the woman who inspired the story. Chris Wasser is here with all the week's new movie releases, including the new Bono documentary. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. I hope you're doing well. My voice sounds a little strained. I'm just back from Japan. Yes, I was there on a News Talk mission with the great Bobby Kerr. And we were there for 5 or 6 days in Tokyo and then down to Kyoto. An incredibly interesting place. Full of history, full of very tall, crazy looking buildings, full of very unusual places to shop and buy food, full of greenery, full of urban sprawl, a fascinating place. We could spend a whole show talking about it. You don't want to hear that. It was just delightfully interesting. Really friendly people, which I don't know, maybe wasn't what I was expecting, but incredibly friendly people. And the streets looked hoovered. Like I could not find any litter anywhere. The only downside I will say you is it's very long to get there and very long to get home. And me and a colleague from the Irish Times nearly missed our connecting flight in Doha, as in we were literally at the gate about to close. It wasn't our fault. The flight had been delayed, but we just made it. There was people ringing ahead on walkie-talkies and all. It's a horrible feeling missing a flight, particularly if you're in Doha and you're due home. No disrespect to the people of Doha, but that was the only hairy moment in an otherwise wonderful trip to Tokyo and Kyoto. So on the plane, I watched a couple of things I wanted to quickly mention to you because there's a lot of time when you're flying to Tokyo. But Speak No Evil was a film we talked about with Neve O'Reilly earlier in the RAR, where James McAvoy plays this overbearing guy, meets this other man and his wife. Scott Maneri is the man, and he's too familiar, and he invites them to their home in the English countryside after they meet in Italy, and things get really weird, and James McAvoy says some really strange things to him, to Scott's family and their child, and it's creepy. It was based on a Dutch movie and they change it up a little. A creepy good movie all about overbearing men and modern masculinity. Speak No Evil. It's on digital platforms now because I saw it advertised a few weeks ago and I wanted to watch it, and I did, and it's well worth a watch. What I also watched is Ezra on the plane, but it's on Prime TV, where Bobby Cannavale plays a comedian who has an autistic son and he's troubled by the fact that they want to send him to a special school. His comedy career is trying to make a breakthrough with maybe a spot on a late night TV talk show host show, and he regularly invokes his son who has autism in his online routine. He ends up running away with his son and Robert De Niro plays his father. It's not a bad watch. If you're looking for a kind of sweet, heartfelt drama with some sad stuff in it as well, Ezra on Amazon Prime. It's something called Amazon Prime is all you need to say anymore. It's pretty good. Something else I watched on the plane, I bemoaned to you last year that the new season of Frasier, the new iteration, isn't really worth the squeeze because you just have a feeling of, you know, why are they doing this again? And I said that to you at the time, and a couple of people have subsequently said to me, oh, I kind of like it. So I watched 3 episodes. I did laugh, I did smile, but I'm still left with the same feeling of, did we really need this? And I'm sorry to say, I think the new iteration of Frasier isn't justified. Having watched 3 episodes again only 2 days ago, I also on the plane watched a kind of fascinating documentary about a pop star I hadn't really paid much attention to. It's not really my bag, that being the music of Celine Dion. But there's a great documentary about her called I Am Celine Dion. You may be aware that she has this very rare condition called stiff person syndrome, which, as the name suggests, makes you go incredibly stiff and other pretty awful things happen to you. And they capture her going through very honestly some of these things that happen, to the point that we see her collapse in her own home, and it's very raw. And of course, it traces her career and her desire to return to the stage. So I found it quite a powerful watch. And I think for people who don't like Celine Dion's music, I know they kind of reframe it in a way when she's on stage that you could kind of see the appeal of it, I have to say. But I am Celine Dion, no matter what you think of her music, is worth a watch. So that's also available on digital platforms for your viewing pleasure. Now, getting back to the business at hand, that was my plane watching. But my regular watching on TV this week was this.
I adore this sister of yours. She is sweet and kind and good. And we have been true blue friends from the minute we met.
Yeah.
Instant besties.
It's like a total mind merge.
Good for you. I can't usually be friends with people who pay me.
Okay. So let's head over to the reception.
Yeah.
And we'll let your sister unpack.
Oh, she's not staying here. I'm just sticking her in here for now.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just gonna crash wherever Simone lives. Where do you live?
I live here, stupid.
You live at work?
Well, I'm a live-in assistant. I have my own suite in the main house.
Oh, looks like I will be staying.
That's fine. We're very, very happy to have you. Let me know where your luggage is and I'll have it sent over, sweetheart.
Oh, no luggage. I'm just gonna wash my undies in the sink.
Great.
Yes, now you heard Julianne Moore there, Megan Fahey of White Lotus fame, and Millie Alcock of House of Dragons fame, although she seems to have grown up a lot since the last time I saw her. This is from Sirens, which is on Netflix. It launched last week. Julianne Moore plays Michaela Kiki Kell, who's a billionaire and kind of cult leader, you might even say. She's a conservationist of raptors. She has this strange group of ladies who lunch, who kind of follow her. Millie Alcock plays Simone DeWitt, who's become a PA to her and is kind of drinking the Kool-Aid and has become much more than her personal assistant. She has to do pretty much everything for her and constantly validate her. Julianne Moore is married to a kind of laconic Kevin Bacon who's very good in it. Megan Fahey is Millie Alcock's sister in this, Devon DeWitt, and she's at home minding their father, played by Bill Camp, who has Alzheimer's, and her life is somewhat falling apart a bit and seems to have a bit of a drink problem and is a bit all over the place, and shows up on this weird kind of island where her sister is now PA to the aforementioned cultish leader, Julianne Moore. And strange and often very funny things ensue. This is really kind of great. I got a great laugh from this at times, and I was utterly entertained for all five episodes, and it barrels along. And all the leads are in great form in this. It's kind of really decent TV. Sirens. I won't tell you much more about the plot because I'm always accused of spoilers, but Sirens on Netflix has a great cast and a great weird story set on a very luxurious island, and Kevin Bacon's in it, so it can't be bad. So that's Sirens on Netflix. Gosh, I've been talking a lot. Do let me know what you might have been watching, either on a plane or at home or in the cinema. John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. After the break, the one and only Gillian Anderson. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, opening in cinemas this very Friday, the 30th of May, is The Salt Pat, the true story of husband and wife Rainer and Moth Wynn, who took a 600-mile trek along the beautiful but rugged Cornish, Devon and Dorset coastline, all along the southern coastline there. Why did they do that? It wasn't for kind of having a laugh or, you know, a better way to spend their retirement. They were forcibly removed from their home. As the bailiffs are literally coming in the house, Rainer, she's called Ray as well, sees this book all about the southern coast and decides in that moment that they're going to walk it. But they've no money and they only have a tent and some essentials. So they go on this walk and they meet all kinds of different and interesting and mostly pleasant people. They have some mishaps as well. And I don't think it's a spoiler to say that there are some health issues with the couple as well. But this is kind of a story of hope as well. the lady at the center of it, Rainer Wynn, and indeed Moth Wynn, but Rainer wrote the book about this journey, The Salt Path, that she underwent. And now they've turned it into a movie. And Gillian Anderson, opposite Jason Isaacs, who plays Moth, plays Ray in this. So I got to talk to Gillian Anderson, who is stars of too many things to mention, from The X-Files to Sex Education. I got to talk to her about playing Rainer, but I also got to talk to Ray herself, who wrote the whole book and whose life this is all based on. Ray, you know, this is your life, but I was really taken in the movie and also reading about it that the bailiffs are in your house and you see this book and you go, that's what we're going to do. Like, that sounds very cinematic. But what was that actual feeling for you at that moment when you saw that book? Can you describe that? Was it like, this is my way out? Or where did your head go?
That moment, it absolutely happened that way. We were under the stairs and the bailiffs were hammering at the door and we just weren't quite ready to leave because we just knew the moment we stepped out of that door, we'd never, ever go back. And it was in that moment I saw the book in the packing case. And we'd already discovered by that point that we had nowhere to go, that as we walked out of that door, we would become homeless. And it was as if knowing that gave the next day no purpose, as if it became just an empty void, because what we were losing wasn't just our home, it was our business, it was the whole framework of life.
Yeah.
Everything that we'd built for 20 years, everything that held the shape of our lives was going, everything.
Yeah.
And so what came after that was just like nothing. So I saw that book and I didn't see 630 miles. I didn't see a path that was equivalent to Everest four times. I just saw the map and I saw a reason to go on into the next day, something to just carry us forwards into some sort of purpose, really.
Yeah.
And that's what I saw. I saw a way out.
Yeah.
A way out in that we could put a rucksack on our backs and walk, and it would be a reason to live, really.
Yeah. Well, it seems like you found that. Gillian, I also read that the makers of this always wanted you. So I guess it's a relief that you said yes. But I wonder, when you initially heard about it, was there something in you you thought, yes, I want to do that, because it's such a profound story?
I had listened to Ray's audiobook of it and had tried to chase it down to option it.
Oh.
And had at one point, when the screenplay was taking a little while, was having conversations with one of the producers about, should it not come to fruition, I am always here in case you need somebody else to, you know, to write, you know, or to produce this or to make it happen. And so, you know, I heard that they were close and actually things are moving forward, and they were very happy with the direction it was going. And so I backed away. And then I think maybe a year later or something, I heard that I had an offer to do the Salt Path, which came a completely different way. And so I met with Marianne, the director, and we just immediately started talking about all our favorite moments in the book and how amazing it was and would be. And just, you know, that was the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah. I found your up againstness, your partnership with Jason Isaacs, brilliant. It just, you really felt like you deeply cared for each other. And I know it's called acting, right? So it's no big surprise. But I wonder, did you, like, is that just you guys have been doing this a while and you can pick the beat up? Or did you spend a bit of time getting into that zone? Because it was very believable.
Oh, good. I'm glad it was that believable. I mean, we obviously we would have spent a lot of time together. We are actors.
Yes.
I have.
I noticed.
I have been you know, worked hand in hand with particularly male actors over the years, where, you know, he may not be that close or have that much chemistry or have that much to say to each other, or maybe, you know, where you're able to manufacture or deliver what is required in a scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jason and I have been wanting to work together for some time. And, you know, who knows what is... what bit is what? What bit is real and real, you know, perceived care? I mean, the degree of the care that Ray and Moth have for each other, unless you're acting, is not going to be manufactured in a couple, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there has to be an element of acting as if, and that's what we're paid to do. So
yeah.
I'm glad it was believable. And I when I saw it, I believed it too. I was surprised, not surprised in that, but you know what I mean? I thought, oh my gosh, that actually we look like we fit, but we look like we're the same.
You definitely
we
do.
I was very pleased with that.
Yeah. Ray, you know, in the movie, you know, you could be mistaken, I think, for two people, middle class, middle-aged, if I may be so bold, who are doing a walking holiday. And yet you're homeless. And, you know, in Ireland, we have over 10,000 people who are homeless. And there is an image of a homeless person that it's some, often a guy on the street addicted to something. It is part of the mission of this film, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, to show you that homelessness can happen in all sorts of ways. Because that's kind of what I took away from it on one level.
I'm not sure if that's the mission of the film. I think you'd have to ask the directors and the producers that. But that was the experience that we had on the path, was that probably easier to describe it, but earlier in the walk, we were often asked by people as we were walking, how come you've got so much time to walk so far? And initially we were answering quite honestly, it's because we've lost our home, we've got nothing else to do. And people would actually physically recoil, even drew their dogs in on retractable leads. So we sort of switched our story then, so that when people ask the same thing, we said we've sold our house, just having a midlife moment, going wherever the wind blows. And it was incredible to see the different attitude of people through that. And I think you do actually display that in in the film. That sense of all the preconceptions we carry in society about what a homeless person is, how they come to be homeless, is so prejudged. When everybody who's homeless actually has their own personal story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Gillian, I was just wondering, you have a very interesting ethnic makeup, I suppose. There's lots of different components to you, and you lived all over the world as a child, and you've traveled, obviously, all over the world. And I read this thing online about you today that described you as bidialectical. That you can switch into different dialects almost unconsciously. And sometimes, now maybe we all do that to an extent. I actually thought for years you were Australian. Does that thing bidialectical, does that make sense to you? Have you experienced that, that sometimes you're somewhere and you just suddenly speak with a different accent? Or is it just people in the media write that stuff about you and you go, oh, yeah, maybe I am?
I think by the bidialectical, they're referring to British and American, because I grew up between the two. And so, yes, that does make sense to me, because it shifts depending on where I am for a period of time, because I grew up between the two. So it's quite natural to me. I don't I'm terrible at Australian, and I haven't actually properly tried it because I'm so bad at it. So I'm not quite sure. It's usually pretty much just between the two.
Okay.
I mean, I did find Ray's way of speaking really difficult to get And I slightly became obsessed with it and had to let go of it, and just because it's quite unusual. The when I was studying, you, sometimes you lean in to words, and then sometimes you soften up. You go from soft, almost whispering to quite harder. Not forceful, but where in the balance of the two of them, and my brain just literally could not figure it out. And so I had to make a choice to like settle somewhere that felt like it was, that felt like it made sense, that it was close enough to the way that Ray's accent was, and how she speaks, and just had to settle with that because I was driving myself bonkers with it.
Well, look, you pulled it off. And if it's not a strange thing to say about such a serious movie, it's a lovely watch. I watched it on Saturday night and it left a warm feeling all over me. So lovely to see you both, and good luck with the film and everything else in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, guys.
What is it? 500 miles?
More like 600. Shall we?
Got nothing better to do.
This isn't the campsite, you know.
Local seem friendly.
Are you walking the path?
Yes, we are.
That's a long old hike.
Yeah.
Retired, are you?
Open up, Mr. Bayliss.
Homeless, actually.
We lost everything.
Look me in the eye!
Coward.
Our home, our livelihood. Maybe we should just follow a line around the coast. We just walk.
You ready?
Can't move my arms and my legs, but apart from that, good to go.
A clip there from The Soth Path. And before that, you heard me talking to Gillian Anderson and also Rainer Wynn, who Gillian Anderson plays in the movie The Soth Path, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 30th of May. After the break, Chris Wasser on the week's other new releases. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time. So we were talking about The Soth Path before the break. There are other new cinema releases and other things on streamers, not least of all, the patron saint of Ireland, Bono, has a new documentary. With what else at its centre? Only Bono. But we're also going to be looking at a movie on Apple TV from Guy Ritchie and a fascinating sounding and indeed looking movie called The Ballad of Wallace Island. I didn't get to see any of these this week because, as I bored you earlier in the show by telling you, I was far away in Japan. But thankfully, some things we can always depend on, like Chris Wasser's ability to go to the cinema and then digest it for us. Good afternoon, good evening, good luck, Chris. How are you?
John, I'm very well. Thanks for that lovely introduction.
Yes, indeed. You'd never tell I'm sleep deprived, would you?
Never, not in a million years.
So listen, The Ballad of Wallace Island. I love the sound of this. I watched the trailer earlier. Give our listeners a sense of this. A music festival of sorts.
Yeah, for one man, basically, it's essentially the story of a lonely millionaire who decides to spend his fortune on trying to get his favorite band to get back together so that they can play a gig outside of his house. So
worse ways to spend your fortune.
There are so many worse ways to spend your fortune. But you have Tim Key, who's just a delight in everything, but especially good here as Charles, who's this lovable oddball who basically... He has more money than sense because he won the lottery twice. Now, I know some listeners might think that's quite far-fetched. It is. But at the same time, the way the story is delivered about Charles's double lottery win, it's so funny and so moving that you kind of just go along with it. So he lives alone. That bit is important. Didn't always. On a Welsh secluded island named Wallace Island, a fictional rock where nobody ever visits and nothing ever happens. But that's until Charles convinces his favorite musician of all time, a chap named Herb Maguire, played brilliantly by Tom Basden, to play a gig on the beach near his house. Now, Herb Maguire was one half of Maguire Mortimer, who were told in this world were, you know, the biggest selling British folk duo of 2014. They were huge. They were on the cover of every magazine, NME, Mojo, or whatever, played every cool venue up and down the country, sold a ton of records. And it was Nell Mortimer, played by Kerry Mulligan, and Herb, and they were romantically and musically involved. But that dream came crashing down when Herb, shock and horror, decided to go solo. So they haven't spoken in 10 years. Charles thinks he can get the band back together. But here's the thing, John. Herb thinks Herb has had, you know, a rough 10 years. He tried to, you know, make a crossover into pop. That ended, you know, embarrassingly for him. He thinks he's just coming to the island, playing a solo gig for a couple of hundred people, collecting a ton of cash and going home. He doesn't know that Charles has hired him to just play for him. And that he's also made a similar deal with Nell, who, again, they haven't seen one another in 10 years, to basically reunite and just play this gig for one man. So it's quite a complicated setup for Herb. And to further complicate matters, Nell has brought along her American husband. So I probably don't need to tell you how that goes.
Somewhat awkwardly, I would imagine.
Yeah.
This was based on a short movie, I gather.
It is, yeah. So it's based on a short film that was originally released in 2007. So you have Tom Basden and Tim Key. They're not just co-stars here. They're co-writers. They created this whole thing. So they came up with this short 25-minute thing in 2007. The one and only Herb Maguire plays Wallace Island. That went down the storm. It was more of a comedy sketch. There was a touch of drama there, but there was also a heart of gold. And it picked up a few awards. It was nominated for a BAFTA. And I think Basden and Key, alongside James Griffiths, who's returned as a director, they always wanted to make a full feature out of it. But, you know, careers got in the way. And that's a good thing because, you know, they all went on to do great things, and Carey Mulligan especially.
Yes.
So they've been kind of waiting for the stars to align so that they could extend this thing. And I know some people might think there's a danger with that sometimes. You know, short films are short films for a reason.
That's why I mentioned it. I wasn't just doing it for SH1s and giggles, because often that is exactly what happens. But I'm sensing from what you're saying, this is a bit of a gem.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think the feature-length format enhances everything here. It gives the drama more room to breathe. It allows for Charles's backstory to be explained, you know, because there's a great deal of grief there. As I say, there's a reason he's living alone on this island. And it also gives us more time to get to know Herb and Nell, you know, who are the musicians here. And we learn more about, you know, what happened with their careers, why they went their separate ways. It's a real gem. I mean, it's just, so the songs here, John, are particularly good, because that's a crucial thing when you're telling a story about a fictional band on the big screen. You know, you have to be able to convince audiences that this band were popular for a reason, because the songs are great. And that's a hard thing to do, because you have to go off and write songs that are good. And Tom Basden, I think, has done that. The moments where himself and Carey Mulligan are sitting down and relearning all their songs together, they're quite beautiful. And it's lovely too to watch Charles watch them. It really is. You said it there. It really is a gem, John.
Okay, wonderful. And people, of course, will know Tom Basden. He was the long-suffering brother-in-law and newspaper editor in Afterlife opposite Ricky Gervais. I interviewed him about it. He seemed like a lovely guy. And he's a decent actor as well. So a gem, a funny gem as well, which sounds wonderful. So what are you going to say stars-wise for The Ballad of Wallace Island?
Yeah, it's funny, thoughtful, soulful. It's really about, you know, a trio of music lovers and players kind of coming together, you know, and navigating their shared heartache the only way they know how, which is, you know, kind of just playing and listening to one sad song at a time. I love this film. Love the look of it. Love the songs, the performances, the heart. It's the full 5 stars.
Oh, he hasn't been there in a while, folks. A full 5 stars for The Ballad of Wallace Island. We better take a clip.
This isn't where the gig is.
Well, you're half right. It is where the gig is.
Where will the audience be?
Oh, no, you just concentrate on what you do best, playing your wonderful music. And I'll concentrate on what I do best, sort of sitting on a pallet.
But, I mean, there's no... How do you ticket this?
Don't worry about that.
You said there'd be 100.
No. No.
Well, yeah, you did.
Fair's fair. No, I did not say there'd be 100.
Yeah, you did.
No, I didn't. I said there'd be less than 100.
How many less than 100?
Well, just as in...
As in... Is it just you?
Yeah.
Right.
That's a clip there from The Ballad of Wallace Island, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 30th of May. Chris Wasser, who's reviewing this week's releases, is giving it a whopping 5, and he doesn't hand them out lightly. I can assure you that, folks, as you probably know. So, Chris, I'm definitely going to have to check that out. I have Apple TV, so should I be checking out Fountain of Youth, which I think arrived last week, but we didn't get to it?
I'm not sure you should be, but I'm also, look, it's such a weird film. It's a bit of an Indiana Jones knockoff, in that, you know, it's about this archaeologist adventurer who's chasing down the, you know, so-called Fountain of Youth, with help from, you know, various family members, from an oily billionaire and also a kid. So there's an awful lot of Raiders of the Lost Ark, Last Crusade stuff happening in there, and it's directed by Guy Ritchie. So you have John Krasinski playing this chap named Luke Perdue, who's a bit of a disgraced archaeologist turned treasure hunter. He's sort of continuing his dad's quest to find the so-called Fountain of Youth. And to do that, he needs to steal 6 paintings, all of which have clues as to where this fountain is. Now, who's funding this expedition? A billionaire, but played by Domhnall Gleeson, who says that he's dying of liver cancer and he wants to find the Fountain of Youth so that, you know, he can get better. And in order to find the paintings for us, Perdue enlists his estranged sister, played by Natalie Portman, who's an art curator, and they make a trip around the world. They're in Ireland at one stage, they're in Austria, then they're in Egypt. And look, if you've seen one Indiana Jones films, you've seen this, because Guy Ritchie and James Vanderbilt, they're not making any sort of effort here, John, to have this film stand on its own 2 feet. It's so derivative, it's actually quite painful to watch.
But is it meant to be derivative as a joke? Is it meant to be like the Dewey Cox Walk Hard story or whatever that movie is
that
called?
Would be great. I'd watch that. I would, but it takes itself quite seriously. And I mean, even little things like, it's revealed at one stage that Krasinski's father's name was Harrison. And I think maybe that's thrown in there for a laugh. But when I say, John, my eyes rolled into the back of my head, I think I gave myself a concussion. I don't like things like that. You know, it's quite smug. It's, you know, it's far too pleased with itself. And I just... Also, they've gotten the central character all wrong. So Indiana Jones is, you know, Indiana Jones could be, you know, a bit rough and, you know, quite arrogant. And, you know, he had a temper on him, but he also had, you know, that undeniable charm. You're always rooting for him. You want to know this guy. You want to be him. That was Harrison Ford doing all that heavy lifting. Here, Krasinski's playing just a bit of a jerk. You know, someone who's way too cocky, way too arrogant, with very little to show for us. He essentially just bullies his sister all the time. And that's kind of a problematic plot line, which I couldn't get my head around, because she doesn't want to do this quest with him, but he just kind of manipulates her into doing these things. And it's not a good look. I thought the performances were quite poor. Domhnall Gleeson, God love him, he's trying. And I can't blame him for taking these gigs. You know, I'm sure they pay well, but he is much better than this. And just as well, like, none of it really makes any sense. It talks too much. It overexplains. And this is becoming a huge problem. This thing costs $200 million to make.
Oof.
But it's just so flat. It's so dead. It's just terrible to look at. So poorly lit. At times, John, I just wondered, was this generated by AI? It's so disappointing. So much talent involved here. I don't think Guy Ritchie should be directing these kinds of films.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a weird thing for him to be doing, surely.
Oh, it's a very weird thing to be doing. I mean, probably not as weird as Guy Ritchie's Aladdin, let's face it.
But well, I suppose, yeah.
But at the same time, I didn't hate Aladdin, but, you know, at least there was some life in the performances there. There's just, you can practically hear this film straining to kind of make it, you know, a new franchise. You know, it sets itself up for two sequels. I don't want any of them. I am actually a little disappointed to learn that it's been a hit so far. So I think we might see another one.
Okay. One movie was too much, you're saying. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Fountain of Youth, now streaming on Apple TV?
Oh, I just thought it was a horrible waste of money, a horrible waste of time and talent. So one star.
One star. And if this is being so successful so far on Apple, why do you think so many people are watching it then?
I don't know. Maybe people are sticking it on for their kids. Maybe they're putting it on while, you know, they're watching it while they're doing something else. It's so weird, John. Like, these are the kinds of films that used to destroy careers when they were on the big screen because they'd never make a profit. But now they're on streamers that, you know, give them access to large audiences. And even if people just watch a few minutes of it, that counts as a watch, that counts as a hit. So this is where we are, unfortunately.
That's a whole other conversation we may return to. So listen, we have a new Bono documentary called Stories of Surrender. It's called Stories of Surrender. His book was called Songs of Surrender. So I read Songs of Surrender because I'm a pretty big or mid-sized U2 fan. And I found with the book, and I'm saying this as a way for you to get into the movie, but I did enjoy the book because that man has lived some life. Like, let's face it, whatever you think of him. But I found about three quarters of the way in, his voice just started to weigh a bit heavy on me, that it was quite self-grandizing, is maybe overstretching it a little, but full of kind of portent and wisdom and just occasionally too self-regarding that I got tired of it as it went on. Does this film suffer from that?
Yeah, a little bit, but I still liked it a lot. I know what you mean. I'm a mid-sized U2 fan myself. I think Bono, maybe sometimes I'll be in trouble for this, but I think sometimes he gets a lot more flack than he deserves.
I agree with you wholeheartedly.
And yeah, I enjoyed the book. I mean, but I also found the book surprisingly moving, quite funny, and it did what all good memoirs should do, in that, you know, it told you an awful lot about this chap who you think, after, you know, 40 years of being in the spotlight, we know everything. We didn't. Mm-hmm. And all that stuff at the beginning about him, you know, facing his mortality and, you know, being on that, you know, surgeon's table and wondering, you know, having his heart operated on and wondering, am I going to make it out of this? That was all, you know, engaging and then also educational, because we really didn't know about that stuff. So this is sort of, this is a companion piece to the book, a companion piece to another companion piece, because, you know, Bono had this book tour in 2022, 2023, where he showed up in intimate venues around the world, whether it was the Olympia Theater or the Beacon Theater in New York, which is where this film was recorded. And he decided to share stories from the book with a live audience, but also songs. And when other people do this, they show up, John, they sit in a seat. Sometimes they'll have, you know, someone interviewing them. And it's all very straightforward. Bono said, screw that. And he took Jackknife Lee with him. He took various musicians. We've got Crash Ensemble's Kate Ellis. We've got St. Sister Harpist Gemma Doherty. And they decided to make a performance piece. They decided to make something of an opera out of these excerpts from the book. So we don't have Bono showing up and, you know, recounting tales that are already on the page. He's performing, you know, passages from his own life. He's reenacting passages from his own life, whether it's, you know, the pint he used to share with his dad in Finnegan's on a Sunday, where he, you know, all he wanted was his father Bob to just say, you're doing well. He performs the both of them. Whether he's reliving the time that you two had their first band meeting in Larry Mullen's kitchen, whether he's, you know, reliving the time Paul McGuinness gave them an awful telling off after they almost considered breaking up in 1980, he's reliving it, and he's doing it's a little bit Beckett-esque at times, because it's just him and he's mimicking all of these, I was going to say characters, but these real people. And then in between, broken up, are reinterpretations of U2's music, performed by Gemma and Case and Jackknife. And I should say, if his storytelling is good enough to hold this film, it doesn't even need the music, you might think. But the music, his voice, John, I don't know what's happened in the last few years, but it's in terrific shape. I mean, this is a point in his career where the voice should be cracking, where it really should be, you know, he should be slowing down, but he's not.
Yeah, but you see, if you rest it for a while, because they haven't toured in a couple of years.
That's true.
You
know,
that can help. It is a muscle, they say. And listen, just if you're going to use a Beckett adjective, Beckettian is much better than Beckett-esque. But listen, that's not
fun. Right. Okay.
It, you know? In terms of what he's doing here, I mean, that is a pretty clever thing to do, or certainly inventive, that he's not just telling them on a stage. He's reinterpreting moments in his life and acting them out for us. I mean, you have to admire the ambition of that, which I think you do.
Oh, I really do. Yeah, it is quite clever. Some people might find it a little bit pretentious, might find it a bit too talky and heavy. But what I really liked about it is the self-deprecation that he is. There's a bit of self-awareness for the first time in forever here, John, where he's acknowledging the fact that, you know, he's this, you know, over-regarded, overfed, overpaid rock star. And is he a bit of a hypocrite? Yes, I am. And he kind of, you know, answers questions that nobody in the room is asking, but that other people outside have been asking for 40 years. You know, is it all not a bit, you know, are you a bit much here, Bono? He knows that. There's a reason he's marketing this film as, you know, tall tales from a short rock star. So there's a wonderful sense of humor there. There's a wonderful self-awareness. And I just found him, you know what? I found him to be terrific company for the 90 minutes. So much so that when it was finished, I thought, I'd watch that again. I kind of just, I liked Bono telling stories. And, you know, he gets to play the rock star in this thing, but he's a very good storyteller. And I'd love for him to tour this again. And you know what, as well, I would love to have seen this in a cinema, because although it did premiere at Cannes and it had, you know, 7 minutes standing ovation and, you know, all of his famous friends were there and they all got to see it on the big screen, the rest of us have to watch it on the small screen because it's an Apple film.
But you think it behoves the big screen, yeah?
I think so, yeah. I think Andrew Dominik, he's a wonderful Australian filmmaker. You know, he's done experimental performance films with Nick Cave before, which I've quite liked. He does a cracking job here. Like, the whole thing is shot in slick monochrome, you know, blends the live performances with the storytelling very well, because, you know, we have close-ups that obviously you wouldn't have had if you got to see this thing live. And he messes around with it a little bit. Not too much, but just enough that you're sitting there thinking to yourself, I would love to have experienced this in a cinema with you know, a huge U2 audience. But look, saw it on the small screen, still worked its magic. I like this a lot, John.
Yeah, it sounds like, I really like the sound of this, I have to say. Bono, Stories of Surrender is now available on Apple TV from the 30th of May. So Chris is saying definitely check it out. Presumably one for, you know, the Bono friendly people or
I think it might convert a few people. Okay. Because my brother is not a Bono fan, and I texted them afterwards and I told them I think you'll really like this because, you know, he's a great admirer of Beckett's work, but he did respond by saying, I hate Bono, not watching it. so it you know, we might have to try a little bit harder to get the non Bono fans to watch it, but I think they'd be surprised if they did.
Okay, so what would you say stars wise for it?
I'm gonna go with 4.5.
Ooh, gee. Yeah. He's had his Weetabix this week. Well, apart from Fountain of Youth. So that is Bono, Stories of Surrender, now streaming on Apple TV. And that was Chris Wasser talking to me. Chris, thanks a million.
Thanks, John.
Chris Wasser there with all the new film releases, both on the big screen and small screen. And next week there will be no show. I'm taking a little break. There will be a show on the radio, a kind of music special about the best songs and movies, but that won't be podcast or anything like that. So a little break from the norm next week while I have some much needed R&R. Or if you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Enjoy the remainder of the weekend. Enjoy the long bank holiday, and I'll talk to you all real soon.